for starters, what I'll say is as is often the case here, this is pretty informal. There'll be points where, for some of the details, I'll be, you know, reading directly from texts that I've written, but a lot of the time I might extemporize on a point, and I want all of you to feel free at any point to raise a question. Also, I'm fully aware that I'm in a room with people who will probably be able to give particular attention to certain points when it comes to the Indic traditions with which Yeats was engaging. So if you actually hear anything that sounds off, call my attention to it, by all means, and then I can rectify things. How many of you are familiar at this point? I know some of you are, but with the poetry of William Butler Yeats, I know that you're quite familiar.
Some.
Okay. And so I'm going to do a little general background, but ultimately the gist of the talk is going to be his engagement primarily with Patanjali, though secondarily with the Upanishads, all as he encountered them and as he understood them, and examine how he arrived at some of the sort of distorting lenses through which he viewed these texts, and what that indicates about Yeats as a poet. I'll open essentially with the general introduction that you may have read in looking at the flyer. Sometimes a lying sentence, which is what Yeats called the following sentence, can prove revealing. This is a case when in his 1934 introduction to Bhagwan Sri Hamsa's The Holy Mountain, Yeats claims, "I know nothing but the novels of Balzac and the aphorisms of Patanjali." In setting a worldly French novelist against an Indian mystical philosopher, that said, Balzac was not without his own sort of undercurrents of mysticism. I think we need to qualify that a little bit. Yeats is not merely recasting the dialogue of self and soul, which has governed so much of his poetry. He's signaling that one side of the debate has staked out its position in India and that the terms of the discussion have changed. Though he had found poetic inspiration in India earlier in his career, and we'll touch on that, Yeats's final and most productive foray into Indic traditions would challenge his conceptions of self, God, and destiny. The resulting shifts in his thought found expression in some late poems and plays, as well as in the 1937 of his vast hermetic work, A Vision. It was first published in 1925, and there are some significant differences between the 1925 edition and the 1937 edition. I won't have time here to discuss those in any detail. The main thing to keep in mind is that the 1925 edition posits a kind of eternal return in which we are all sort of circling the wheel of lifetimes, identities, and experiences perpetually. And he doesn't posit any kind of transcendence, any kind of liberation from the wheel, whereas in 1937, very significantly, he actually does. In order to trace some of those changes, the best place to look, as it turns out, is not really so much his published work, certainly not his poems and plays, but actually in his letters and in some of his essays and introductions in that period. One of the things that's interesting about Yeats is you'll often hear poets talk about how poems write themselves, or they simply sort of wade into the process of composition and work things out from there. Yeats's habitual manner of writing was actually to write out an argument for a poem in prose and then convert it into poetry. At least he said that at certain points. I think with that in mind, some of the stuff in his journals and his letters and his essays and introductions actually exposes the workings of his mind in ways that may become a bit veiled in the poems. What's interesting is that those letters, those essays, some journal entries reveal exactly what interested him from 1931, really through the end of his life in 1939, about Indian philosophy or Indic traditions and exactly where he got things wrong. He and the nature of his mistakes had a lot to do with notions he picked up about Indian traditions very early in his life. What we're going to deal with primarily is his last decade. But what I'd like to do first is set some of the groundwork for the momentous event, I think much more momentous in Yeats's career than scholars realize, which was when, in April 1931, Yeats met Sri Purohit Swami, an Indian holy man, a disciple of Sri Hamsa, who had come to the West to ostensibly disseminate his traditions, his lineage's teachings. And that would be the beginning, as I'll explain later, of a very fruitful relationship. Yeats famously ends the first part of his autobiographies, Reveries Over Childhood and Youth, with a kind of plaintive last line: "My own life seems to me a preparation for something that never happens." Well, you could argue that's kind of a universal human sentiment, but in his case, it does open a tentative window on the kind of strivings or the kind of orientation that Yeats brought to his work from a very early point. And that is that he wanted something to happen. He wanted some extraordinary, defining, transcendent experience. He wanted some, gnosis. He wanted some kind of access to a higher realm that would redefine his relationship to himself and to the world. And with that in mind, I think we have to keep in mind that in the broadest sense, however much his views may have changed, and however much, and we'll talk about this later, Yeats ultimately refused to commit for any, definitively or permanently to any particular tradition, philosophical, religious, or otherwise. He was fundamentally a religious person. And his very good friend, and who had been with him early in his life, a fellow occultist, and later much more inclined toward mysticism, George Russell, known as A.E., that was his nom de plume. He wrote of Yeats, "It was, I think, to get rid of the skeptical element in himself so that he might have a whole faith that he had ventured into magic and spiritualism, hoping for the clear fact or experience or sign which would enable him to have an untroubled faith." Well, what is George Russell referring to there? Yeats was certainly in the first half of his life, and all the way really until his final decade, when he seems to have let a good deal of it go. And I think the word "seems" is very important with Yeats. He had an abiding interest in Hermeticism, in the occult, in not just spirituality, but spiritualism. And it was all folded in with what a lot of scholars now, historical and literary, are sort of rediscovering and starting to work on, which was what has been called the mystical revival of really the second half of the 19th century, which was spurred by a number of things. And as some of you well know, the availability of translations of Indic texts was part of it. The kind of late phase romanticism that recalled not just, medieval, impulses and traditions, but also Renaissance Hermeticism. And the revival or emergence into public view of secret societies, the establishment of new secret societies. And Yeats himself was very, very much involved in trying to prove that there was life after death, which led to him being very involved in, as I said, spiritualism, seances, that sort of thing. But he was also a long-term member, and again, I don't have time to go into it in detail here, of the Order of the Golden Dawn. And the Order of the Golden Dawn was, like the Theosophical Society, in some ways a kind of, whatever else it was a kind of university, I think, for artists and writers, performers and extraordinary personalities. who were drawn to a highly ritualized form of hermetic or esoteric philosophy, and who were drawn to magic. And I think the distinction between magic and mysticism is an important one for Yeats, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But what George Russell is arguing here is essentially that Yeats was trying to shake off a skepticism that he had really inherited from his father in order to find some certitude. And as a result, through much of his life, he did play the role of a kind of spiritual bricoleur. He would do a bit of this, a bit of that. It was precisely the sort of thing that he would, for which he would later be criticized by T.S. Eliot in a series of lectures Eliot would actually later try to disown, published as After Strange Gods, in which he said that Yeats committed the grave sin of trying to synthesize his own religion, trying to come up with something for himself, stitching together things from different traditions, and that kind of personal syncretism is spiritually extraordinarily hazardous. And it committed Yeats, as Eliot said, to a lower mythology. It's a spiritual universe, but as Eliot says, it's the wrong spiritual universe. It doesn't have enough sin in it, you know, and that sort of thing. But it does mean that, among other things, he adorned his poetry with a good deal of symbolism and a good deal of allusions to the great sort of hermetic traditions that he had studied. And it's kind of compelling because some of those symbols actually do find their way into Eliot's poetry as well, and it's an interesting question as to what they meant to him. Ultimately, though, he would gravitate in his last decade more toward Hinduism than anything else, as he understood it. He did not read widely in Buddhism, though he did refer to it. But he did get direct instruction in some Hindu traditions. Now, how really authentic, how valid that instruction was is open to question. But it's interesting because as he grew older, Yeats also, he became more conservative. Politically, he became extremely conservative, at least for a time, and extremely class conscious. But he also bought increasingly into the notion that the ancient wisdom is probably the truest, the most ancient, or as he put it, ancient salt is best packing. So for him, the old, you know, as he, you know, the time honored, you know, traditions of India constituted arguably, you know, the oldest, the most supreme, the sort of wellspring of human wisdom on a certain level. And his encounter with it was framed, and it's really important to recognize this. Throughout his career, there is a tension within Yeats that informs all his work, and it's a tension that he did not really always... Actually, usually he did not try to resolve it. He used the friction of opposites, of antinomies, to try to generate poetic heat, so to speak. And he loved drama, the drama of these kinds of opposing forces. And so a dichotomy that runs throughout his work is the tension between the idealistic or the spiritual man, early in his career characterized by Shelley, for instance, though, as we'll see, he later repudiated Shelley. His eyes fixed on a higher unity, and an earthy, passionate man, his gaze ranging over the multiplicity of the phenomenal world. For Yeats, whose ultimate ideal was what he called unity of being, a phrase which he used multiple times, but never quite adequately described or defined, it certainly at least partly means healing the breach between the many and the one, ultimately. And his sense of a broken relation between humanity and the sacred, and his nostalgia for a kind of pre-lapsarian engagement with life, it sounds awfully romantic. And he did at one point in one of his poems refer to himself as one of the last of the romantics, but he also said it in the past tense. And in his later years, in the 20s and 30s, he was what you might call a recovering romantic. And he does, but he didn't hold all. He didn't lose that ideal. In a later work, Wheels and Butterflies, he actually spells out his ideal, which is that the earth becomes once more, not in rhetorical metaphor, but in reality, sacred. Okay. So what did Yeats actually believe? I think the best way to cast Yeats's convictions throughout his life is in terms of Paul Tillich's phrase, ultimate concern. And that however he might approach it, and however he might actually address the question of faith, the important thing was it was the central question in his life. He was very, very clear about that. As early as 1892, he said in a letter to his father that the mystical life is the center of all I do and all I write, et cetera, et cetera. And at that point, mystical covered a great deal of territory for him. It included the hermetic and the occult, as well as what might be in a more academic contemporary sense called mysticism. And fundamentally, for Yeats, spirituality was about experience, particularly about the experience of higher consciousness. And, you know, whether he was pursuing a kind of initiatory hermeticism with MacGregor Mathers, in particular in the Order of the Golden Dawn, or studying meditation with Perlheit, he was drawn to reach across the distance between the earthly and the transcendent. And in this sense, if we define mysticism, and I think a good working definition, we could use something, you know, Evelyn Underhill defines it as the science of ultimates, the science of union with the absolute and nothing else. In a more contemporary context, the theologian Hans Küng defines it as a deliberate striving for direct inner experience of God's reality. And Yeats certainly had a strong mystical streak in him, but he also was very much involved in magic, and certainly in the first two-thirds of his life. And Evelyn Underhill makes a very, very stark distinction in that magic seeks control, it seeks power, it arrogates to itself, it seeks to know and to use rather than to be. The mystic seeks to be. And I think Yeats, in keeping with his temperament, was reluctant to commit himself conclusively to either orientation. For him, poetry is at least in one sense a mode of knowledge and a mode of mastery, and it's fundamentally acquisitive a good deal of the time. And in a distinction that echoes that of Evelyn Underhill, the critic Dennis Donahue distinguishes between erotic poetry and sacramental poetry. And he categorizes Yeats as erotic in the sense that he asserts the primacy of the poetic ego over the object described. He does not so much celebrate what he is talking about. He celebrates himself talking about it, or he celebrates himself coming to an understanding of it. I think it's rather a rather crude point to make. I think both elements are strongly present in Yeats. But there's no question that the tension is there. And he does remain suspended a good deal of time between knowing and being, or as he frames it in one poem, The Choice, he writes, it's just a two-quatrain poem, but the first quatrain runs, "The intellect of man is forced to choose perfection of the life or of the work, and if it take the second, must refuse a heavenly mansion, raging in the dark." So Yeats was clearly caught up very early on in the problem of, well, if drama and tension and anxiety and passion, above all, fuel poetry, must I give up my work, must I give up my poetry, perfection of my poetry, in order to have perfection of my life? And that became an abiding concern for him. In 1930, a year before he met Perlheit and would begin studying Patanjali, he wrote in his journal, "I am always, in all that I do, driven to a moment which is the realization of myself as unique and free, or to a moment which is the surrender to God of all that I am. Could those two impulses, one as much part of truth as the other, be reconciled? Or if one or the other could prevail, all life would cease." And I think if a skeleton key exists to the poetry Yeats wrote in the last decade of his life, that passage is probably it. He's torn between a defiant, heroic, to a certain degree Nietzschean assertion of his individual will on the one hand, and on the other, complete self-surrender to the absolute, letting go of his individual separateness completely. And he doesn't want to resolve that dilemma. He's getting too much poetic mileage out of it. And on the other hand, he also actively resists, as we'll see, the notion that liberation might actually mean, so to speak, the drop dissolving back into the sea, his individuality being left behind. Since he draws his passion and his poetic energy from there, he's not going to give it up. He actually says at one point, "The poet must not seek for what is still and fixed, for that has no life for him. And if he did, his style would become cold and monotonous." And it's fascinating that he should say that he should be, at this point in his life and in his journal, rejecting what is still and fixed, because when you consider how fraught that is with spiritual implications for somebody who has spiritual aspirations or ambitions, because the principle of stillness is, of course, so central to so many traditions, certainly central to Patanjali. And the notion that a hard-won interior stillness is absolutely essential to being able to open up to the experience of whatever divinity you may find within you is one that he simply doesn't want to fully accept. And in that sense, the choice, as he called it, can be represented, and I think this is the last really important piece of context before getting to the India piece, is represented through much of his career by a Western sort of dialectic between Plotinus on the one hand and Nietzsche on the other. And Plotinus was the first to arrive. And he hung around. He was sort of the touchstone in some ways for Yeats. I know that at a party in 1935, for instance, or 1934, he said to Virginia Woolf, she recorded in her journal, that all wisdom is in Plotinus. So he was not jettisoning Plotinus in 1934, at any rate. Of course, it's very easy to read Plotinus, and some speculative scholars have, as participating in a wisdom tradition that may well have had its roots in northern India. Plotinus, after all, did try to get to India in order to, supposedly, according to Porphyry, try to speak with the sages there, or whatever. The idea of trying to be able to trace that kind of thing at that point in history and what began where, you know, it's sort of, it's purely speculative. But I think what's important here is that Plotinus does pose a fundamentally mystical vision of the cosmos. But what's interesting about Plotinus is that he differs from the traditions that Yeats would subsequently study with Purohit on one huge point, or he can be read as differing. And a point that proved especially convenient for Yeats. In the Enneads, 5-7, he seems to suggest that souls returning to their home in the intelligible world retain their individuality, so that liberation is not incompatible with the retention of your character, as actually Yeats would call it. And it's interesting, Yeats is being selective, because Plotinus actually does equivocate on the point of whether one actually retains one's individuality on returning to the One. You know, on the one hand, in Enneads 5-7, he says, if Socrates' soul is eternal, then the authentic Socrates, to adopt the term, must be there. That is to say, the individual soul has an existence in the supreme as well as in the world. And that's from the translation that Yeats actually studied later in life. But earlier in the Enneads, in 4-9, he addresses the question, Plotinus, more directly and reaches the conclusion that the very existence of many souls makes certain that there is first one from which the many rise, which suggests that if you're going to complete the arc of ascent, to join the One is to give up separateness altogether. And the appeal of Nietzsche lay in his posing precisely the opposite view, which is that you would never withdraw from the turmoil of individual existence into transcendent consciousness, but rather embrace the flux of manifestation and exercise the prerogatives of a liberated individual will. A way that you might frame it in the terms of Evelyn Underhill is that Plotinus is focused on the timeless bliss of being and Nietzsche on the tumultuous the joys of becoming. One of the things that I am addressing in my criticism, in my work on Yeats, is that I think critics have tended to read him as being, particularly in his last decade, far more of a Nietzschean than he really was. I think he loved Nietzsche's style. He loved sounding like Zarathustra. But I think in his last decade, he was not a Nietzschean. I think that for the simple reason that once you commit to the notion of being able to be liberated from human suffering, you're no longer a Nietzschean. At any rate, and it's interesting because Nietzsche himself, the rhetoric of Nietzsche, and I think work needs to be done on this, I'm not sure how much has been done. If you read certain passages in Nietzsche, they sound an awful lot like people like Eliphas Levi and those 19th century occultists. I mean, if you were to rehear this passage, "Would you govern yourself and others? Learn how to will. Strength cannot prove itself except by conquest." I mean, 9 out of 10 people would say, "Oh yeah, that's Nietzsche." No, it's Levi. You know, and I have very little doubt that Nietzsche had done his reading in that area. So it's kind of interesting. And I think it's also compelling that Yeats first encountered Nietzsche right at the turn of the century after he had ended, after all sorts of controversies, ended his relationship, more or less, with MacGregor Mathers. And it's possible that, in a sense, he moved from his father to MacGregor Mathers as a kind of father figure. And when MacGregor Mathers kind of left the scene, Nietzsche sort of filled that particular space for him for a while. But at the same time, he had been engaged with India for a long time. In 1884, you know, before he was even 20 years old, one of his aunts had sent him a theosophical book, A.P. Sennett's Esoteric Buddhism, which has very little to do with Buddhism. But imagine yourself being a really spiritually ambitious 18-year-old and picking that thing up. I mean, you'd really catch fire, you know. And in 1886, the London Theosophical Society sent Mohini Chatterjee to Ireland, to Dublin, and he lectured to Yeats's newly found, he started the Dublin Hermetic Society. Mind you, he's very young now. He's like 20, 21 years old. And he and George Russell are mixed in with this together. And fascinated them with his particular version of Advaita Vedanta, which was a little off. But it was actually romanticized. I think it was sort of given a bit of a silky sheen to appeal to these young Irishmen. And yet Mohini Chatterjee's presentation of Vedanta exercised a lasting influence. He would later, Yeats, in 1928, write a poem titled Mohini Chatterjee. He would also try to contact Mohini Chatterjee years later. And Mohini Chatterjee, being too busy being a successful and prosperous lawyer, I believe in Bombay, could not be bothered to respond. But in any case... The other really important encounter with India prior to this was with Tagore. And you can make a strong case that Tagore became the first non-Westerner to win the Nobel Prize because Yeats made it happen. Yeats at that point, thanks to his experience with the sort of Irish revival, you know, the theater, all sorts of things, he had become an absolute expert at running publicity machines. And he promoted Tagore to no end. And this is not at all to say that Tagore did not deserve that Nobel Prize, but I think he would not have been on the radar for the committee had Yeats not brought his full talent for marketing to bear on Tagore's campaign. But he also revered Tagore at the time. He loved that Tagore, as he saw it, was absorbed in God. And even described himself at one point as having had to close Tagore's book, and this say that I believe it was Gitanjali, lest some stranger would see how much it moved me. And it's very interesting because what impressed Yeats about Tagore the most was that he seemed to heal that breach, so to speak, that I mentioned earlier. He seemed not to be a renunciate. As a kind of bhakta, he was practicing a spirituality that, at least to Yeats, appeared to tap the passions rather than require one to still renounce them. rather to direct them properly. So it was a kind of extrovertive, world-embracing mysticism. So Tagore became for him, at least for a while, the ecstatic, life-affirming antithesis of a dry, sterile Christianity, an innervated Christianity. That didn't last. Yeats actually had Tagore's star sort of fall, and it was largely over literary matters, believe it or not. I think Yeats said that Tagore should never have written in English at one point, that it ruined him. But I think also part of the issue there was that Yeats, being much more of like, I would argue if I were to just categorize him crudely, was much more of a jnana than a bhakta kind of guy. He wasn't, that was going to bore him, that kind of total self-surrender, that kind of devotional approach to spirituality. He wanted knowledge, you know, and the power and the drama of knowledge. And it was in 1931, as I said, that he met Sri Purohit Swami. Yeats was sufficiently impressed by Purohit that he asked him to write his autobiography. And in 1932, the resulting book, An Indian Monk, was published by Faber, by the way. And there's an interesting side note here in that the cultivation of Purohit and then Hamsa's books was part of what... It was an interesting sort of piece in the relationship between Yeats and T.S. Eliot, who were sort of like frenemies all the way through the 30s in very interesting ways. And Yeats went, you know, was absolutely thrilled with what Purohit had to say about his own experiences. He pronounced it one of the great books of the world, a book that must affect every thought men have about the East. He said, and I think this is a very telling remark, in his introduction to the book, he proclaimed that it seems to me something I have waited for since I was 17 years old, which would be about when he read A.P. Sennett's Esoteric Buddhism, when Sri Purohit Swami fitted everything into an ancient discipline, a philosophy that satisfied the intellect, I found all I wanted. And you can almost see there, that's probably what he didn't feel like he would have gotten from Tagore. And yet it feels like what he was getting from Purohit. And he saw an opportunity by dealing with Purohit to publish authoritative testimony about the experience of mysticism. He wrote to Sturge Moore, the guy who actually introduced him to Purohit, Europe has ideas and believes none of them because we lack spiritual experience. He has that. So, you know, with one sweep of his hand, he discards the entire Western mystical tradition, so to speak. And he says, you know, I want to learn from this guy about actual techniques. I want to learn practice from him. And it was precisely these matters of practice that he would pursue through several years, actually, of study and collaboration with Purohit. The two main volumes that they worked on and that their relationship was built on were translations of the Upanishads, or several of the Upanishads, and of the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. And some literary critics have examined the translation of the Upanishads, and I'll address them a little bit because some of Yeats's misconceptions can be found there. But they haven't said much about Patanjali, and I think it's frankly because very few literary critics are going to feel comfortable wading into that territory. But it's interesting. Not only did Faber end up publishing An Indian Monk, ultimately they also published The Holy Mountain, which was the autobiography of Sri Hamsa, Purohit's teacher. Yeats's introduction to that book is another very revealing window on his thinking at the time. Basically, after the Ten Principal Upanishads was translated and completed in April of 1936, Purohit consulted Yeats about his translation of the Yoga Sutras. They worked on that together, according to Yeats's letters, in 1936, which was eventually published in 1938 by Faber as Aphorisms of Yoga. And Yeats wrote an introduction to that book in 1937. So you're looking at, from 1931 to 1937 at least, a sustained engagement here, which really is second in terms of sustained engagement with a kind of teaching tradition that is second only to Yeats's engagement with the Order of the Golden Dawn, which was much earlier in his life. But there is one other engagement worth noting, and that was Yeats's engagement between 1887 and 1890 with the Theosophical Society. Now, are you guys familiar with the Theosophical Society, more or less? You know, Blavatsky and all that. It's really interesting here, because this is where we start to be able to look at Yeats and see a certain kind of Western occultist Orientalism. Because that's certainly what Blavatsky was trading in with her sort of mashup of things that she had read and sort of put in a blender and kind of packaged neatly for Western audiences. And it's interesting because if you put it in the larger context, in the 19th century, a Western notion of Hinduism, that kind of construct, had been built. And then even further than that, Richard King has referred to what he calls the Vedanticization of Hinduism. That for the West, it was just very, it was simpler. And certainly for certain Brahmin in India, it was certainly helpful, you know. To sort of foreground Vedanta as opposed to other traditions as more palatable to Westerners, and there's a whole cluster of motives there. I would say also part of what that gave birth to was might be called the Perennialist Project, and Blavatsky in some ways was one of the most popular initial proponents of this notion of a perennial wisdom that could be found at the heart of all traditions, but found its highest expression in Indic traditions as she presented them. But it's interesting because in literary criticism, the Vedanticization thing persists. In his book, W.B. Yeats and Occultism, even so astute a scholar as H.R. Bachchan refers to, and I'm quoting, the Shankaric or Hindu school of philosophy. You know, as if Shankara's Advaita Vedanta is one and the same as Hindu philosophy, whatever that is. But in any case, from 1887 to 1890, Yeats was a member of the Theosophical Society in London until he got kicked out for insisting on, you know, first Blavatsky allowed him to develop what was called an esoteric branch. And they were doing things like seeing if they could reconstruct a rose from ashes, you know, things like, you know, just sort of trying to do essentially sort of magical kinds of practices. Blavatsky did not approve, and eventually their differences came to a head, and she more or less kicked him out. He didn't frame it that way, but that's really what happened. And his departure didn't leave him bitter at the time. He said, and yet I may join them later on, you know, I may get back together with them. But in 1931, when he found Purohit, he felt he had a trump card over the Theosophists to some degree. His letters scornfully contrast the abstruse speculations of Theosophy with the seeming purity of Purohit's wisdom. In March of 1932, he wrote to Olivia Shakespeare that the Swami could testify to the reality, as he says, of which the Theosophists have dreamed, how they will hate its homely precision. In another letter to Gwyneth Foden, a woman who turned out to be no end of trouble for him and Purohit eventually, he referred to the vulgarization of mystical philosophy by the Theosophists. So he had nothing good to say about them, you know, in relation to Purohit. But it does speak to the sometimes rigid nature of his thought that despite his professed disdain for Theosophies, and regardless of the fact that he'd parted ways with them 4 decades before meeting Purohit, he would not or could not relinquish certain notions about Indic traditions that he had picked up from Theosophy. And that's where we get into his misreadings. there are some clues to his misreadings, actually, in his reading of the Upanishads. He got, before he met Prohi, he already had read some of the Upanishads. But in preparation for his work with Purohit, he read Robert Ernest Hume's translation. And he wrote a lot of notes in it that were actually very revealing. In a textual note dated January 23rd, 1932, he underlines the following sentences by Hume. "The final unity could not and would not then be found outside of self, but in it. In truth, the self is the unity they had been looking for all along." Now, given that Yeats was fixated on this notion of unity of being, you would expect him to underline something like this. And he would explicitly link his principle of unity of being with the self as presented in the early Upanishads in his late general introduction for my work. But his subsequent annotations reveal major points of confusion. Hume's introductory essay explains the Upanishadic principle, broadly put, that the self is pure subject. Thus that world ground, Hume writes, that unity of being which was being searched for realistically outside the self is none other than the self, which had eluded cognition for the reason that as the subject of consciousness it could not become an object. Yeats's marginal note reads, "But it is." So he was right there not accepting that sort of pure subjectivity that one can read as essential to the notion of the self being put forward there. And in fact, to a certain degree, by writing that those three words, he's rejecting that central tenet of the equivalence, so to speak, or of Atman and Brahman. Yeats compounds this, and this is where it gets interesting. He compounds this fundamental by error by insisting on a real self that is somehow not his individual self and somehow also not the supreme self. There are several marginal notes that display his deliberations on this point. He writes, "Only the real self knows the real self," with capital R, uppercase R and S. He writes in one, at one longer note, "Not a word is said in this essay about the relation of Buddha to the Upanishads. His teaching bridges the gap between the undivided self, the ego, and the real self. He shows us how to become what we really are, i.e. by a true transformation of our being. For a true understanding of Buddhism, we must get to the essence of the Upanishads and vice versa." So he's still talking about this. Forget about the historical and doctrinal considerations here, but he's fixated on this notion of some kind of real self. And you can tell he's troubled by this notion of actually surrendering one's separateness, because on page 110 of his copy of Hume, he asks plainly the question that has troubled him about the Upanishadic notion of liberation, at least in the Upanishads he's read. "Who then," he writes, "does the person become?" It's interesting because what he's trying to do is locate this real self between the individual personality or the individual self and the supreme self as a kind of happy medium, presumably a purified personality that would allow him to attain emancipating wisdom without surrendering his individuality. And to the best of my reckoning, no such entity really exists in the major Upanishads. Correct me if I'm wrong. It's a tricky notion, maybe. What I can say is that such a self absolutely exists in the discourse of the Theosophical Society. Because on the pages of The Path, the Society's most important journal, they're full of debates and elaborations on the nature of the transmigratory self. The question actually caused considerable confusion and even controversy. In a May 1890 article, which would be right around the time that Yeats was still a member about to depart, in an Alexander Fullerton write, "The word ego, too, is confusing. Thus we read of a personal ego, an immortal ego, a reincarnating ego, and the like, till the word is so altered and qualified that one's conception of what an ego or the ego really is extremely vague and misty." Madame Blavatsky actually plugged into this and decided to resolve it. And in The Key to Theosophy, which is a very odd book, it's sort of half apology, half catechism, she affirms what she calls the existence of two egos in man, the moral or personal, and the higher, the divine or impersonal, calling the former personality and the latter individuality. According to Blavatsky, the individuality is our imperishable ego, which reincarnates and clothes itself in a new personality at every new birth, a poor pilgrim on his way to regain that which he has lost. The higher ego, then, is not the same as the Atman, which, according to Blavatsky, is, and I'm quoting Blavatsky, no individual property of any man, but the divine essence, which has no body, no form, which is imponderable, invisible, and indivisible. So that she very clearly positions a kind of real self in between the two. And I think it's significant that he's conjuring up that notion that he would have picked up probably back then at this point. She literally calls this real self the real man, occupying a middle state between illusion-bound individuality and the supreme self. And I think that the fact that Yeats imported this concept into his reading of Indic scripture caused him no end of problems. Because, you know, from the standpoint of a good deal of Indic thought, positing such a real self means trying to transcend separateness and keep it too. It's a bit like trying to eat one's cake and have it too. And that desire led him into some misreadings of the Yoga Sutras. Now, I'm assuming I don't need to go over very much of the philosophy of Patanjali here, am I right? Just in terms of a quick review. Essentially dualist, though one could argue that in the last portion it starts to sound a bit non-dualist, I don't know. But is everybody familiar with the whole property Purusha as conceived in Samkhya and Yoga and all that sort of stuff? We don't need to do that. What I will jump to, and I think this is the part where it gets interesting, is Yeats' history with the Yoga Sutras, because there was a sort of translation, a very free translation of the Yoga Sutras, or the aphorisms of Patanjali, as they were called, that circulated in the Theosophical Society when Yeats was a member. So he first encountered it there, but he also encountered it, and this is a fascinating little note here. In his introduction to Purohit's translation, he refers to having purchased some years ago a Harvard edition, translated and edited by James Horton, he calls him, it's Houghton Woods, considered impeccable, he writes, even by a famous poet and student of Sanskrit who used it as a dictionary. And the poet in question is unmistakably T.S. Eliot. And it's fascinating because he dismisses Wood's translation, Yeats does, as filled with scholar's cant. And he's clearly trying to promote the relative simplicity of Purohit's translation, but the remark also suggests that Yeats had found Wood's rendering maybe a bit too difficult. And Purohit's instruction is being presented as an alternative approach to the philosophy and techniques of yoga, unmediated by Western scholarship, right? We're going right to the source here with Purohit. Now, we can't know all of Purohit's and Yeats' deliberations about the Yoga Sutras, but much can be inferred from extant documents, their correspondence, you know, things like that. Most importantly, Yeats does seem to have had a basic grasp on the relatively accessible yogic principle of Chittavritti Nirodha. It finds its way into much of his writing in the 1930s. And I think a lot of, if you look on your handout, the notion, not just of, you know, however you want to translate it, you know, suppression of the modifications of consciousness or whatever, also the notion of one-pointedness is interesting. On the backside, you see Riv considers Christian love insufficient. That's a longer poem, but there's one interesting passage here that has arguably some Indic overtones that literary critics have not sufficiently addressed. You know, then my delivered soul herself shall learn a darker knowledge, and in hatred turn from every thought of God mankind has had. Thought is a garment, and the soul's a bride that cannot in that trash and tinsel hide. Hatred of God may bring the soul to God. It's a really powerful, characteristically Yeatsian stretch of poetry. And it's fascinating because literary critics have tended to interpret trash and tinsel as referring to the accoutrements of ritual and ceremony. And I think it's very clearly a reference to thought itself, in a way. And I think also there's an echo in here, in that line, hatred of God may bring the soul to God. Just think of Ravana, you know, just think of, you know, Hiranya, you know, these people whose hatred is a form of one-pointedness, right? Characters who are liberated because they are one-pointed. It doesn't matter the nature of the one-pointedness. And you know, it's fascinating because it was when Yeats began studying Patanjali that he rejected Shelley. Absolutely rejected Shelley. He had written in 1900 a long essay on Shelley in which he praised him as, you know, as a visionary, as a as someone who wrote poetry of infinite desire. Which is fascinating because he's no longer interested in infinite desire, or he, at least at this point, doesn't seem to be. He, in a, what I would consider a veiled self-indictment, Yeats actually strips Shelley of his spiritual laurels. He says, Shelley was not a mystic. His system of thought was constructed by his logical faculty to satisfy desire, not a symbolical revelation received after the suspension of all desire. And he even describes methods of meditation involving meditating on symbols that were characteristic of his earlier occult pursuits, but have very little to do with Patanjali. In fact, he now rejects Shelley as spiritually bankrupt, really a kind of a case study in spiritual sickness, to the point where he says, you know, Shelley's responsible for a lot of really bad stuff that happened to people I knew in the 19th century. The parade of contemplatives in his later poems, and I've included some of those poems here, passages from them, from the Lord of Cho in Vacillation to the serenely non-attached sages in Lapis Lazuli, which actually I would consider the culmination of his study of Indic traditions, all reflect a more yogic ideal of meditative practice. Long-legged Fly, which Yeats completed shortly after reviewing proofs of Purohit's translation of the Yoga Sutras, and that's a piece of timing that critics have overlooked. It's always interesting what a poet was actually, so to speak, was on the bedside table while he or she was writing a poem. And in the case of Yeats, he was spending a lot of his days working on proofs of an edition of Patanjali when he wrote Long-Legged Fly. And I'll just read it very quickly and talk a little bit about Long-Legged Fly and, you know, that civilization may not sink, its great battle lost. Quiet the dog, tether the pony to a distant post. Our master Caesar is in the tents where the maps are spread, his eyes fixed upon nothing, a hand under his head. Like a long-legged fly upon the stream, his mind moves upon silence. That the topless towers be burnt and men recall that face, move most gently if move you must in this lonely place. She thinks, part woman, three parts a child, that nobody looks. Her feet practice a tinker shuffle picked up on the street. Like a long-legged fly upon the stream, should be her mind moves upon silence. That girls at puberty may find the first Adam in their thought. Shut the door of the Pope's chapel, keep those children out. There on the scaffolding reclines Michelangelo. With no more sound than the mice make, his hand moves to and fro. Like a long-legged fly upon the stream, his mind moves upon silence. It's fascinating. It's funny, there's actually an interesting story connected to that, that he'd been searching for an aquatic metaphor for the experience of samadhi, I think. In relation to ordinary consciousness. And at one point, he had field-tested one in the form of a turtle in a garden pool at Dorothy Wellesley's house and decided it was unsatisfactory. He finally settled on a water bug. It is a fitting metaphor for an awareness whose power and agility are founded on depth and stillness. And it also reflects, arguably, Patanjali's principle that the buddhi is the subtlest of the vehicles, functions at the surface of the bottomless consciousness of the Purusha. And I think this is actually one of Yeats's finest achievements, this poem, because it fuses his notions of East and West and philosophy and lyricism with remarkable economy. You don't get some of the bombast that characterizes his more hieratic mode of poetry. You need only compare it to the Statues, written later the same year, to appreciate its seamless effectiveness. The later poem is disjointed, it's abstract, and so crammed with sweeping speculations and pronouncements that it scarcely holds together. Long-Legged Fly reads effortlessly. Its deliberations are resonant, but it's a relatively unostentatious poem. It's through simple diction, imperative voice, assertive trochaic meter, he gets his point across without, waxing hieratic. And you can see the interesting thing here, in each of the poem's three stanzas, an elliptical adverbial clause frames a dramatic situation, followed by a direct instruction that both envelops the reader in the drama and affirms the importance of the contemplative stillness required by Caesar, Helen, and Michelangelo. Yeats closes each stanza by narrowing the reader's field of vision to one body part in its activity, the eyes of Caesar, the feet of Helen, the hand of Michelangelo. That distillation both resists abstraction and focuses the reader's attention in a manner that mimics the one-pointed concentration of the three figures. And apart from acknowledging gender in the case of Helen, the poem's refrain remains constant. You know, like a long-legged fly upon a stream, his mind moves upon silence. Rather than placed at the end of the stanzas, it's suspended in the space between them. By ending at in the word silence, it actually invokes what it names, and asserts that silence as the ground of all discursive thought. As Dennis Donahue points out, the refrain holds the mind to what is permanent while everything else changes. This evocation of interior stillness suggests that human greatness is inseparable from the achievement, by discipline or by destiny, of a kind of samadhi. The mind, brought to the condition of chittavritti nirodha, no longer arrogates to itself the sense of I-ness, and therefore no longer makes decisions driven by ignorance and delusion. Quieted, it fulfills its true function as an interface between Purusha and Prakriti, allowing the wisdom and power of the self to determine a course of worldly action. And it calls to mind Patanjali's analogy of a purified Buddha to a colorless crystal. Now, you can hardly say, for instance, that Helen of Troy was a sage, but if you're going to say that by virtue of karma or destiny she was capable of achieving a kind of citta vritti nirodha, that the power she enacts in her life comes from that. And it's interesting, because when you look at it, he doesn't establish any of these people as liberated beings, but rather what might be called karmic instruments, destined to perform acts that have enormous spiritual repercussions. And it's interesting, because as some critics have pointed out, I mean, there are lots of ways to read their different functions, but you could very easily read them as performing the three divine functions of Caesar as preservation, Helen as destruction, Michelangelo as creation. A simple change of word, you could say Helen growing into her, another way of looking at it, Helen growing into her seductiveness is the destroyer of civilizations, Michelangelo enshrining the genius of the Renaissance in his depiction of the biblical creation on the Sistine ceiling could also be seen as, you know, the creator of civilization, and Caesar defending the empire as the preserver of civilization. It's fascinating. He also depicts his three protagonists arguably in a sequence that captures the progression from contemplation into action. Caesar is depicted as entirely passive, listening inwardly, his eyes fixed upon nothing, and of course, being fixed on nothing is not the same as not being fixed on anything. And the stillness and the receptivity of his intellect will allow him not so much to decide as to intuit what to do in the approaching battle. Helen inhabits, part woman, three parts a child, a liminal space between both childhood and womanhood and contemplation and action. And her childish practicing of the Tinker Shuffle does anticipate the seductive power she will have in maturity. And she's already drifted into a lonely place outside the social order, from which she will effect its undoing. Michelangelo, painting the Sistine ceiling, generates out of his inner stillness images that define a civilization. Yeats had already, in another poem, An Acre of Grass, described Michelangelo as possessing a mind that can pierce the clouds. And here he links that mental acuity to the condition and the practice of samadhi. So I think it's a very interesting yogic take. I think that there's very little doubt that, so to speak, as I said, what was on his bedside table had something to do with what he was writing about in this poem. But that core appreciation of citta vritti nirodha did not prevent Yeats from exercising a theosophically driven selective reading of Patanjali. The poet's evident belief that he could concentrate on the most subtle and abstract aspects of Patanjali's thought without due regard for its basic prescriptions about actual practice did not help matters. Patanjali establishes a progression from outer to inner stillness for a reason, right? The yamas and the niyamas may be behavioral injunctions, but of course they're not conventionally normative. Their purpose is to begin the process of cultivating non-attachment and stilling one's consciousness. Significantly, Sutra 230 establishes that one of the prescribed observances is brahmacharya, which can be translated as chastity or as continence. The point is not to practice a socio-ethical value of sexual self-restraint, but to still the appetitive passions, which are powerful vrittis. There can be no real progress in Patanjali's system of yoga without a foundational sense of self-restraint. Yeats lacked this, particularly in the department of brahmacharya. His later years were filled with liaisons and affairs, and so some of those behavioral injunctions don't seem to have made an impact on his sense of spiritual practice. Now, another point, which I think is a very compelling one, is that he also appealed to his, as he understood them, tantric traditions, which reportedly he was taught by Purohit as well. That is a different issue. But part of what's going on here is he says in his essay on the Mandukya Upanishad, published in Eliot's magazine, The Criterion, it was fascinating because Eliot privately made fun of him. He said in a comment on that, Uncle William is as loony as ever. In any case, Yeats writes, "To seek God too soon is not less sinful than to seek God too late. We must love." I love that. "We must love, man, woman, or child. We must exhaust ambition, intellect, desire, dedicating all things as they pass, or we come to God with empty hands." Okay. There may be an echo here of the traditional four phases of life in Hindu thought, student, householder, retiree, ascetic, but the passage equivocates. On the one hand, all our actions must be consecrated to God, you know, a principle most prominently articulated for Westerners in the Bhagavad Gita. But Yeats also suggests that one should only seek God after having exhausted desire rather than actively stilled it. Of course, neither yoga nor Vedanta offers any such latitude, but theosophy does. Blavatsky herself, in The Key to Theosophy, asserts that the real man can only attain liberation, quote, "by passing individually and personally, i.e. physically and spiritually, through every experience and feeling that exists in the manifold and differentiated universe, every experience in the human planes." So you can see where he might have tapped that as a way to spin Patanjali to suit himself. And this has trickled into, this misconception has trickled into some good, otherwise good scholarship. Roy Foster wrote what is now the definitive biography of Yeats, and he refers to an allowance for human passions expressed by Patanjali's yogic disciplines. He obviously hasn't read Patanjali. He's clearly confusing Yeats's self-serving theosophical take on the soul's journey to liberation with the altogether more austere teachings of Patanjali. And so it's interesting that Yeats was willing to set aside some of the most basic stuff in Patanjali and focus, as I had mentioned earlier, on some of the most subtle, such as the varieties and stages of samadhi. And boy, does he really screw things up here. In his translation, he had Woods's translation of Patanjali as well, all sorts of notes scribbled in them that are really just about the nature of, really about two things, the nature of samadhi and the four states of consciousness. And his confusion of those two, they're sort of two separate things. And he would just mix and match them in his understanding of Patanjali. He has a comment on Turiya. He's fascinated by Turiya. And And it establishes his interest, which comes to fruition, as you might imagine, in his essay on the Mandukya Upanishad, of the doctrine central, in particular, to Vedanta, of the four states of consciousness. And in which case, of course, you know, you've got the waking state, dream state, deep sleep, and turiya, which is the boundless, non-dual consciousness that transcends the other three and forms their substrate, essentially. I think that's a fair way of putting it. Yeah. And it's that the four states of consciousness and their correspondence to the sacred syllable that and the silence within and around the syllable that forms the core of the Mandukya Upanishad, which he would then write about. What's also interesting is that he focused on the sequence of sutras that discuss the stages of samadhi, in particular samprajnata, or sampragyata samadhi, or samadhi with seed, in Patanjali's system, Vitarka, Vichara, Ananda, Asmita, that sequence. I don't think we need to go into the details there, but we can go into the details of what Yeats thought. He pestered Pruohit with letters trying to clarify the relation between samadhi and sushupti, or dreamless sleep. And in a letter in 1933, he asks, "Can you tell me if the preparation that produces samadhi differs from that which produces unconscious samadhi or dreamless sleep? The point is important to me. I am deep in my essay upon your master's travels, and that is why I care to know." Now, Pruohit's response, if it took the form of a letter, appears to have been lost. I couldn't find it in any of the collections. Most of this is at the University of Delaware in the United States. But Yeats pursues the point a week later with another letter, in which he says, "By unconscious samadhi, I mean pragya, Mandukya Upanishad, which seems to be interpreted sometimes as he who completely knows, sometimes as he who is nearly ignorant, but which, according to the translator, Dr. E. Rohr, is used in the Upanishads in the first sense. The Upanishad says the man in this state has become one. His nature is like bliss. Later on, I find the phrase pragya, the perfectly wise who abides in deep sleep. Sir Arthur Berrydale Keith speaks of the dreamless sleep as a state in which the soul enters the purest light and says this in the older Upanishads. Only three states of the soul were known, waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep. Later, a fourth state was added called turiya, which is a waking state. However, you need not trouble for the matter for the moment. I finished my essay anyway." But it's fascinating because his confusion here is arising partly from his ignorance of the subject. I mean, turiya is hardly just a kind of waking state, I suppose, and partly from an inconsistency, of course, in the Upanishads themselves. In Mandukya Upanishad, pragya is, of course, described as having become one who is verily a mass of cognition, who is full of bliss, and who enjoys and experiences bliss. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad describes deep sleep in similar terms and at greater length, though partly as a rhetorical strategy to describe or to establish the eternal wakefulness of the self, right? But a central narrative passage in Chandogya Upanishad contradicts it, the one in which Prajapati instructs Indra and a demon in the nature of the self, and Indra determines that someone in deep sleep is one who has gone to annihilation and finds no good in it, and Prajapati affirms Indra's judgment. So it's a mixed bag there. Yeats did arrive at what he considered a satisfactory position on the issue. In a subsequent letter, he concludes, "The sleeper in dreamless sleep, the sleeper has no wisdom, but he is lost in the abyss of wisdom," which arguably is fairly consistent with most Advaitin writings, I think, on that. But it becomes more of a problem later because this is where he goes really astray. Are you guys hanging with me here? Okay. I just don't want to talk too long and bore you guys, but. In his essay on the Mandukya Upanishad, and I'm going to ask you to stay with me through a trying passage of Yeats's prose here, he describes the process of meditation, and this is how he puts it. And you'll hear the errors proliferate. "In Patanjali and his commentators, there is a detailed analysis of the stages of concentration that would be Hegelian did they include the self in their dialectic. The first is the fixing of attention upon some place or object, the navel, the tip of the tongue. Any object will serve so long as it belongs to oneself and is an immediate perception, not something inferred or heard of. Or one may fix attention upon some form, or the form of some god, for a god is but the self. But one cannot fix attention without some stream of thought. So if the object be the tongue, one thinks of the tongue as symbol or function. The taste, color, and sound so perceived attain supernormal perfection as fact and idea draw together. Should one choose a god as the theme of meditation, the majesty of his face or the beauty of his earrings may, as trance deepens, express all majesty, all beauty. The second stage is this identity between fact and idea, between thought and sense, an identity that recalls the descriptions of dreams in the Upanishads. The third stage is sushupti, a complete disappearance of all but this identity. Nothing exists but that ravening tongue or that majesty, that beauty. The man has disappeared, as the sculptor in his statue, the musician in his music. In the fourth stage, the ascetic enters one or more of these stages at will and retains his complete memory when he returns. This is Turiya, but as yet, only in the form called Savikalpa. Full Turiya, or seedless samadhi, comes when all these states are as a single timeless act, and that act is pure or unimpeded personality, all existence brought into the words, I am. It resembles that last Greek number, a multiple of all numbers, because there is nothing outside it, nothing to make a new beginning. It is not only seedless, but objectless, because objects are lost in complete light. Okay, that is Yeats on the process of meditation. You can just see him just not... It's the mix-and-match quality is making it a little incoherent. The passage is rife with problems, you know. And this is where if you see me saying anything that technically might be off, I'd really appreciate it. It says, he begins his account with a mistaken notion of the proper starting point for meditation. Patanjali indicates that Vitarka Samadhi can take any external object as its seed, not merely a part of one's own person or a sacred image. Further, Yeats's use of the word thought is ambiguous. If he's using the word to signify any mental construct or vikalpa, his remark is consistent with Patanjali's system, because a seed of object of any kind is a vikalpa. If by thought he means discursive thought, then his assertion that one cannot fix attention without some stream of thought reveals a failure to understand that nirvitarka and nirvichara samadhi, say nothing of ananda and asmita, by definition consist of fixed attention free of discursive thought. After two initial stages, one of selecting a seed object and another that recalls vichara in its seeming abstraction but still involves a union of thought and sense, Yeats then makes the inexplicable leap to a third stage he calls sushupti, by which he appears to mean not dreamless sleep but something like the non-discursive absorption of nirvichara samadhi. At this point, he shifted his discourse from the spiritual disciplines of Patanjali to the cosmology of the Upanishads, from stages of deliberate skilled activity to natural states of consciousness, as if the latter were just like the former. His process runs something like vitarka, vichara, sushupti, turiya. It's a category fault, and untenable in any Indic tradition, I would say. Does that make sense? There. Yeats's confusion over the process of meditation arises partly from his commitment to the notion that sushupti is not merely dreamless sleep, but unconscious samadhi, an exalted state of consciousness achievable through spiritual discipline. There's nothing in the published writings of Purohit or Hamsa to endorse this definition, but neither did they correct it when given the opportunity to review proofs of Yeats's essays. That he believes his understanding is grounded in Patanjali is clear from the from a preceding passage, which, mentioning Turiya and Sushupti, he claims the philosophy and technique of both these states are described in the Yoga Sutras or aphorisms of Patanjali. But Patanjali says no such thing, and neither do his commentators. In fact, Sutra 1.6, which Yeats noted in his copy of Woods, clearly establishes that sleep of any kind is a vritti. Right? In any case, the idea of sushupti that Yeats advances has no basis anywhere in Indic philosophy. I actually ended up contacting, Arvind Sharma, I believe, who wrote Sleep as a State of Consciousness in Advaita Vedanta. I emailed him, okay, let this be absolutely clear. Is there anywhere in Indian philosophy that establishes that sushupti is something achieved by spiritual practice? And he sent me one sentence reply. I know of no such thing. And I suppose he could be mistaken, but It's interesting. The state of Sushupti has inspired centuries of debate among the exponents of Advaita Vedanta, but at issue are the differing positions of the two most important figures in that tradition, arguably, Gaudapada, who emphasizes the ignorance of the soul in Sushupti, and his student Shankara, who affirms the deep sleep as a kind of natural and transitory participation in the bliss of non-duality, but it's common to all, not all sentient beings. In no known tradition of Indic philosophy is Sushupti defined as other than deep sleep, and nowhere is it treated as a spiritual attainment. I mean, on the face of it, it hardly qualifies as a spiritual achievement, because if that were the case, anyone who enjoyed a good nap would be at the threshold of liberation. If Yeats is to be believed, however, Purohit taught otherwise. In his introduction to the Holy Mountain, Yeats asserts that Purohit claims that his master gained at a mountain lake, Turiya, whereas he himself, Purohit, had but gained upon Mount Girnar a dreamless sleep, Sushupti. It's a statement fraught with contradiction in that it describes Sushupti as merely dreamless sleep, yet also as something gained through spiritual discipline. Interestingly, the passage would make sense in Vedantic terms if it claimed that Purohit had gained Savikalpa Samadhi and Hamsa Nirvikalpa Samadhi. But Yeats clearly cannot properly distinguish between Savikalpa Samadhi and Nirvikalpa Samadhi as levels of absorption achieved through practice, and Sushupti and Turiya as natural states of consciousness. When he later attempts to make that distinction, the manner in which he does so reveals his determination to impose theosophical ideas on yogic and Vedantic teachings. And it's here that Yeats crosses a line between what might be called a fair understanding of the spirit, if not the letter, of yoga, into a series of increasingly extravagant and self-indulgent speculations. And here's Yeats. The ascetic seeking Savikalpa Samadhi identifies it with sattva, but calls Sushupti, which he identifies with tamas, the samadhi of a fool, because in that state he is ignorant, and because he is liable to fall back upon it as though sinking into lethargy. But he who thinks Sushupti is the supreme self-surrenderer must, I am persuaded, identify Sushupti with sattva, the waking life of sense, with tamas. Savikalpa Samadhi is, as it were, ringed with the activities of life, Sushupti ringed with dreams, and both rings are rajas, while Savikalpa Samadhi and Sushupti are alternatively light and darkness. Neither is in itself a final deliverance or return into the source. The Vedant philosophers, unlike Buddha, direct our attention to bright or intelligible perfection, but seek timeless perfection, seedless samadhi, beyond it in the isolated soul that is yet in all souls. Now, the relativism that Yeats introduces here has no basis in yogic Vedantic thought, and the qualifying clause, I am persuaded, indicates that he knows he is embarking on his own train of speculation. And the theosophical complexities he's dismissed in his private letters now reassert themselves. This is Yeats again. Those who have attained seedless samadhi are said to be physically immortal. They do not die, but make themselves invisible. The storytellers describe them dissolving their bodies while they seem to bathe, or leaving, like Christ, an empty tomb. At will, they pass into the source. An ascetic who has rid himself of passion may, though unfitted for Turiya, seek, like many Greeks, the wisdom through those self-luminous and coherent dreams that seem to surround, like a ring of foam, the dark pool of dreamless sleep. If devoted to some god, or to some other image of the universal self, he may pass that ring, obtain Sushupti in its highest form, the dreamless sleep of the soul in God. When he returns to waking life, he is still an instrument of that other will. After death, indeed, he attains liberation, becoming one of those spirits that have no life but to obey that self who creates all things in dreamless sleep. And begins to sound a lot like theosophy. That it could also, you could fold it into certain traditions, where obviously there are many, many levels, heavens and so forth. And certainly, you know, Patanjali himself refers to certain, you know, whether it's Prakriti-layas or whatever, beings. But it's interesting, because the idea of Sushupti Yeats conjures here echoes something that appears in the pages of the Theosophical Journal, The Path. In the journal's first issue, Murna Jyoti describes Sushupti, the dreamless state in which the mystic's highest consciousness hunts for and seizes any knowledge he may be in need of, and claims that Sushupti ends when the mystic desires to bring whatever he has sought back to normal consciousness. An 1888 article by Eusebio Urban asserts that the translation of Sushupti as dreamless sleep is inadequate, For while it is dreamless, it is also a state in which even criminals commune through the higher nature with spiritual beings and enter into the spiritual plane. Given that those articles appeared during Yeats's tenure in the society, he almost surely read them, or at least participated in discussions they reflected or inspired. So again, he's projecting theosophical notions of occult India onto Patanjali without necessarily sticking to what Patanjali has to say. And this tendency to arrogate and distort some these principles of Indic philosophy that he finds becomes more explicit in a subsequent passage linking the dominant images of the Holy Mountain to the system that Yeats has articulated himself in a vision. He writes, "I find my imagination setting in one line Turiya, full moon, mirror, bright mirror like bright water, Mount Meru, and in the other Sushupti, moonless night, dazzling darkness, Mount Girnar." In yoking his notions of conscious and unconscious samadhi with the full moon of what he would call pure subjectivity and the dark moon of pure objectivity, Yeats has co-opted particulars of Indic philosophy to legitimize his own hermetic system. The 1937 edition of A Vision reflects those appropriations. Yeats may have felt that he had outgrown the desirous romanticism of Shelley, but neither the homely precision of Purohit nor the austere disciplines of Patanjali could sate the poet's appetite for extravagant visions. And so questions linger. Any collaboration can involve simple misunderstanding or selective acceptance of ideas or deliberate distortion of important principles. The extent to which Purohit consciously participated in Yeats' arguably occultist or orientalist distortions of the Indic texts he read is open to question. To suggest that Purohit taught Yeats the misguided notions of yoga that the poet professed is to locate the Swami outside any established Indic tradition. But to be fair, a good deal of what gets passed down, as I understand it in sort of teaching lineages, is often stuff that's drawn from different traditions. So you have to be careful not to pigeonhole Purohit. Well, he taught him Patanjali. Well, they read an awful lot of books, including some tantric stuff. And I think it's entirely possible that all this was sort of funneled together through Purohit. But there's just no documentary evidence of that. Given the evident theosophical origins of some of Yeats' ideas and the fact that Purohit had ample opportunity to correct any errors in Yeats' essays, it's more likely that the Swami either concurred or that he indulged the misconceptions of an illustrious and willful student. Either course of action implicates Purohit, arguably in the sort of Indo-Orientalist projections that militate against his professed mission of bringing an authentic Indic wisdom tradition to the West. As Richard King points out, to ignore the role played by Asians themselves in the construction of Orientalist discourses results not only in the myth of the passive Oriental, but also perpetuates precisely the East-West dichotomy that is such a feature of Orientalist discourse. Now, we can't know precisely why Yeats's misconceptions, if that's what they were, went uncorrected, at least relative to what he was taught, went uncorrected by either Purohit or Hampshire. We can see that he didn't escape the theosophical influence that he had encountered in his youth. And it's definitely theosophical influence, because even though he had a much longer and more profound engagement with the Order of the Golden Dawn, for instance, than with the Theosophical Society, the Order of the Golden Dawn was very much, as I've read and understood, a Western tradition. You know, they didn't really deal much in Indic stuff. It was very much more geared toward Renaissance hermetic traditions. So he wouldn't have really picked up much. He wouldn't have picked up Patanjali from the Order of the Golden Dawn. He would have picked up a good deal of alchemy. He would have picked up Rosicrucian stuff. He would have picked up all, you know, that sort of thing. But it's interesting because also Yeats never ultimately committed even to these traditions. There are people who knew him who said that he was effectively a convert to Hinduism in his last years. I think that's certainly overstating the case. Yeats, to convert in so definitive a fashion, remember, for a poet who, as I said, derived the heat, the passion of his poetry from conflicting impulses and energies, to commit entirely to one tradition, particularly a tradition geared toward tranquility to some degree, or liberation, or cultivation of sattva, it doesn't jibe either with seemingly his outward behavior, or with the profound passions, and also the doubts of his late poetry. In a very late poem, Man in the Echo, even though he says there is no work as great as that which cleans man's dirty slate, his last poetic use of the word rejoice, which rings through his poetry of the 30s, sometimes in a somewhat Nietzschean sense, but not so often in Nietzschean sense as some critics would like to think. There's one place in particular where he's clearly quoting Jan Ruysbroeck, and yet a lot of critics think it's Nietzsche. But his last use of the word happens here. O rocky voice, shall we in that great night rejoice? What do we know but that we face one another in this place? So that in the end we have him, you know, not, if he does subscribe to the notion of liberation, certainly not feeling that he's anywhere near it. Now, an interesting place to put him as well as, and I think there's work to be done on this, is, as I mentioned earlier, the degree to which the tantric stuff that he had studied appealed to him. Because remember, his rejection of renunciate traditions, I think, probably would have given him no end of trouble with Patanjali. I think he would have found something much more appealing in a more, in a non-dualistic, in a frankly non-dualistic and extrovertive tradition that would redirect, as we had said, the passions, and that would allow him to, of course, at much greater spiritual risk, embrace any given occasion as an opportunity, as a possible opening onto experience of the divine. I think he would probably take the, reject the sort of neti-neti of the Vedantic and to a certain extent, classical yoga traditions in favor of how he would understand Tantra. And he does write about Tantrism in sexual terms in one of his essays. And it's fascinating because, and this is the passage with which Roy Foster ends his biography of Yeats. It's arguably a plea for clemency by Yeats, which is fascinating. He, standing self-accused, as he does, of vacillation, of never having committed, so to speak. Yeats wrote, "When life puts away her conjuring tricks one by one, those that deceive us longest may well be the wine cup and the sensual kiss. For our chambers of commerce and of commons have not the divine architecture of the body, nor has their frenzy been ripened by the sun. The poet, because he may not stand within the sacred house, but lives amid the whirlwinds that beset its threshold, may find his pardon." And I think it's a fascinating and revealing passage that he, in the end, felt that in order to be a poet, he had to live at the threshold of the truth, or of with a capital T, the threshold of transcendence, but not cross that threshold, and to actuate, to experience, and to articulate those whirlwinds that he encountered there. It's fascinating because I think it was Eric Heller who actually said the same thing about Nietzsche, said that the problem that Nietzsche had was that he was a deeply religious man who, it was something like this, he was a deeply religious man who spent his life pacing back and forth outside the temple and wouldn't let himself go in. You know, it's a fascinating sort of judgment on Nietzsche. But in this case, I think it's a fascinating study here of how much of Yeats's later poetry clearly reflects his study of Patanjali and his study of other Indic traditions. And I think there's a good deal of tantric stuff in there too that, of course, I wouldn't nearly have time to talk about here. but at the same time, we see, I said at the beginning, how not just the Order of the Golden Dawn, but even over time, to a greater extent, the Theosophical Society was a kind of university or a way station for a good deal of literary and artistic modernism. And this, one critic even described it as low-hanging fruit for anybody who wants to actually pick it in a scholarly sense, that this really needs to be addressed more fully. And here we have Yeats, someone who clearly crossed paths with the Theosophical Society throughout his life and career, but was only a member of it properly for about 3 years, its influence on him was enormous, and it certainly colored his understanding of both the Upanishads and particularly of Patanjali. And so it's a fascinating study of someone who's steeped in Western Hermetic traditions, who also rebels, and partly in a very self-conscious Blakean sense, against received orthodoxies of any kind, while at the same time revering the most ancient traditions as legitimate. How he still, in encountering, as you know, in a heightened sense, being a poet, as we all must, you know, when we encounter these things, projecting onto it notions that he picked up very early in his intellectual life, and the extent to which those notions that he projected onto Patanjali and onto the Upanishads, particularly that notion of no matter what happens, you hold on to your identity as William Butler Yeats, you know, what does that say about the appropriation or the accommodation that those traditions undergo as they're encountered by Western poets and writers and artists? It's really, really fascinating stuff. And wow, I've actually taken 90 minutes. I was hoping to have time for questions, which we do if anybody has any questions. But thank you for being so patient with that. I didn't think it would take quite that long.
Thank you.
Did anybody hear anything there that really gave them pause, that felt that I was being perhaps a little too rigid or narrow in my reading relative to how Yeats was interpreting Patanjali or the Upanishads? Because I'm very conscious that this not being my field in particular, I could very easily do that.
I have a feeling that you might be underestimating the degree to which Yeats himself had contemplative experiences. Because it sounds to me like he's trying to relate his own experiences to what there is in Patanjali. And he's doing that on the basis of what he learned both in the Order of the Golden Dawn and in Theosophy. And the Order of the Golden Dawn, in my memory, does in fact attempt from time to time to connect what they're doing from a Western tradition with Eastern ideas.
Okay.
They don't make much of it, but they do make connections.
Okay.
Of precisely the kind that Yeats is actually making.
I'll need to go look at that then. I forget the book that's got It's the Golden Dawn. I forget who wrote it. Who has the record of all the rituals?
Yeah, I know the book.
I've got that at home. I think I need to revisit that and I'll look into the Golden Dawn again, because if they did, that would be very compelling. The other thing I would say is this:
how do you spell Dawn?
D-A-W-N, Order of the Golden Dawn. I would backpedal a little bit actually and say, if I were to step back from what is essentially the material of an academic essay. I would agree with you completely. I think there's very little question that Yeats had contemplative experiences, and he describes them in some cases. Actually, in my full chapter, I deal with them, of actually having had moments of illumination, sometimes unbidden. The most famous of which being, and he wrote it into a poem, sitting in a coffee shop in London, and he described, he said, "My body of a sudden blazed." And he wrote into the poem. And for 20 minutes more or less, so great was my happiness that I was blessed and could bless. And also of another moment, unbidden, while at Cool Park, crossing a stream, and suddenly just being struck with a self-transcendence and a kind of bliss. And those are just unbidden moments. I'm quite sure that he had experiences that frightened him that he's documented, while engaged in more esoteric or occult practices. I would agree completely that he had experiences. I don't want to say that he was merely a pretender in this regard. I think that from the standpoint of just looking at his approach to these texts, if I were to try to step back and be as dispassionate as possible, I'll deal with them this way. But I think your point's entirely right that he's trying to link everything to his experience. It was always about experience with him. It's just that in trying to make that connection, he just blurs certain categories in ways that just, as I said, don't really matter to the spirit of the thing most of the time, but that do reflect also things that he picked up in the Theosophical Society. So
you might underestimate the degree to which the early Theosophical Society does actually reflect genuine Indian ideas.
Really? Okay.
It seems to me. You know, there's quite a change, and you're focusing on his connection with it, and then there's the whole development of the Theosophical Society, which I suspect he would have little but contempt for the later development of the Theosophical Society.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
And the Senton Company.
Yeah.
So when you get his critical comments, you probably need to bear in mind that development of Theosophy. And also bear in mind that this sort of attitude to Theosophy was absolutely typical of the Golden Dawn and its inheritors. That's exactly the sort of idea they had about Theosophy, the sort of criticism he makes.
Okay, interesting. So, and that's, yeah, so that's good work for me to do, thanks, to go and look into that. Yeah, I would imagine that he was thinking much more of the Anabizant brand of Theosophy when he's making those comments.
But what he learned from was not that, of course.
Right, exactly. He learned from, I mean, he was in the first 20 years. It's the first 15 years of the society.
Blavatsky is very peculiar. She's full of all sorts of extremely odd stuff, but she clearly, to my mind, has some genuine knowledge of Asian ideas. Quite where and how she got them is not at all clear. But she clearly does. She's mixing it up with everything under the sun, but she does have some.
And yeah, it's fascinating. And I haven't had a chance to read a proper biography of Blavatsky. I think it would be very interesting. My understanding is she had access in her early life to extensive libraries owned by an uncle, I believe, or someone like that, who had a good deal of Hermetic texts there. And of course, she traveled quite a bit and traveled in India in the East. What she encountered there, who knows? But I would also argue just.
I mean, the idea of the higher self actually does seem to me to be perfectly Indian. I mean, it's just that it's Sankhya rather than Vedanta.
Well,
if you talk about Buddhi, I mean, that's really just another way of talking about a higher self. There's something higher than that, but nonetheless, it's a language.
It's
just translating it into a kind of European idiom.
That's interesting.
It would seem to me to be quite in accord with one strand of thought in India, which obviously there are many.
Right, exactly. I mean, I actually do say in my proper chapter in the thesis that Yeats at one point is talking about yoga. He's just talking about liberation an absolute reality, and he's puzzling over whether to regard it as he says, as one being, or as he calls it a congeries of being, and of beings, and technically, as I understand it, if you really take a very very precise line, textually driven line with Samkhya into Patanjali, then liberation in which the Purusha recognizes his own nature does not mean merging into the one. It means there is actually a collection of Purushas, right? That we each have an independent Purusha, which could be read as...
You can read it in many different ways. Yeah. It's extremely difficult to understand what the Sankhya-Karyakara actually do mean when they talk about that. You know, this is an omniscient Purusha, and it's... the whole of the universe of mind and matter as we know it has dissolved.
No more use for it, right?
So exactly what they mean.
Yeah.
And we don't really have enough Sankhya proper literature as opposed to the Vedantin use of Sankhya, which is what survives to later times.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But
right.
That's
the commentaries.
Irrelevant to the Yeats literature, because he knows Sankhya partly through
Right, right, exactly. So and the other really compelling question for me is: I know that in terms of his lineage, and I was discussing this with Gavin a while ago, the deity venerated by Purohit and Hamsa, they go back to Dattatreya. As Gavin described it, really heavy yoga. But a lot of things fold into that. A lot of things funnel into, you know, so who knows what strands were woven in to the teaching that was passed on through Purohit, you know, and that ultimately is unknowable. So it's really, it's tricky stuff to say.
Well, I thought you were a bit hard on the dreamless sleep side, actually.
Really? Okay.
And there's a difference between having dreamless sleep and knowing that you're having dreamless sleep.
And there, yeah, I actually.
That's a very different situation. Yeah.
There's somewhere in the article where I actually do say that, and I'm sorry I skipped over that. Where the point is to be conscious through all four states.
Yes.
And to be conscious in dreamless sleep, that is an achievement, mm-hmm. right? But Yeats never actually anywhere says being conscious in dreamless sleep, and it may be that he just considers it understood. He does say that you bring back, you know, to enter into the others at will at one point, which suggests consciousness, but then he describes it elsewhere when he's talking in another passage about what happened for Purohit at Mount Girnar in other terms, and of course he refers to it as unconscious samadhi, so he seems a bit hung up on that himself. But yeah, I do address that elsewhere in the article.
That kind of level would like that in the article.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Alaya Vijnana in Mahayana Buddhism.
Mm.
Store consciousness, which is, again, not an enlightened state.
Right. So yeah, again, you get into this stuff, it's always very risky. And this is exactly the sort of comment that I really value, because you're getting into such murky territory. You know, that, and yet I'm trying to be able to say something definitive, and I want to, you know, I don't want to be too rigid. That's the thing. It's very, very tricky territory. But,
makes a system for interpreting the Yoga Sutra, but so do all the traditional Sanskrit commentators. I mean, they're not really consistent with one another. They've each made their own system mm-hmm. of interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So he's in a good tradition in that.
So, yeah, and there you have it, at a certain extent. Having done quite an apprenticeship, you might argue, you know, with some pretty high-powered Western figures. You know, I mean, McGregor Mather's nothing to sneeze at, you know. So, interesting. But, well, thank you so much for coming and hanging in for all that. I hope you found it informative.
Thanks for listening.
Yeah.